Good afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David Latulippe. This week, choreographer Hope Moore and composer Beth Wilmert talk about their collaboration for the world premiere of Manifesting at ODC Dance. You'll hear about a multimedia, gravity-defying outdoor dance project being presented on the wall of the Hastings Law School next week. More from the Berkeley Festival, an exhibition from its director, Harvey Malloy. And 80 Lady talks about her one-woman show at the Marsh, From Piss to Bliss. You'll want to stay tuned. From Beth Wilmert from the world premiere of Manifesting, which will be danced by Hope Moore Dance as ODC Theater presents the 9th home season of Hope Moore Dance tonight, Thursday through Saturday. Also on the program is Stay, Hope's 2015 exploration of the creative process of artist Francis Bacon with sound design by Teddy Hulsker. Joining me in studio is Hope Moore and her musical collaborator for Manifesting, Beth Wilmert. Hope is a curator, choreographer, and writer who trained at the San Francisco Ballet School, studied theater at Yale, and earned a BA in Women's Studies at Stanford. She was an AmeriCorps team leader in South Central LA, later moved to New York City to train at the Merce Cunningham and Trisha Brown studios. Her extensive performance career includes stints with Trisha Brown, Lucinda Childs, and Margaret Jenkins. Combining her passion for both community organizing and dance, she earned a JD from Columbia Law School, where she was a Columbia Human Rights Fellow. In 2007, she returned to the Bay Area to establish her own company, Hope Moore Dance, to create, present, and foster outstanding contemporary dance at the intersection of critical thinking and the body. Hope, welcome back to Open Air.
Thank you.
Beth Wilmert has been making music, theater, performing, and teaching throughout the Bay Area and beyond for the past 25 years or so. Most recent Bay Area theater performances include the New Electric Ballroom in Wozzeck for the Shotgun Players, of which she is a company member, plus work for the Aurora and Marin Theater Companies. Beth was a 2009 recipient of the annual San Francisco Bay Guardian Goldie Award, and her numerous other awards include multiple Outstanding Actor Awards nominations and citations from the SF Bay Guardian, Oakland Tribune, San Francisco Chronicle, as well as the Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Awards. She also directs choirs at three different San Francisco senior centers as part of Community of Voices, an innovative medical study on aging and singing, which is a project of UCSF and CMC. Beth, welcome to Open Air yourself.
Thank you.
Well, looking at the brief video I saw of the clip for Manifesting, it's really compelling. It looks like you're doing a lot more than just creating a dance. It's more of a full performance art piece.
Yeah, for Manifesting, I wanted to do something more than pure dance. I wanted to make something more theatrical. I was inspired to work with the genre of artist manifestos. I've always been interested in how artists relate to rules in the creative process and where rigor crosses over into rigidity, and how in the creative process, whether artists are working from internalized shoulds or from a more intuitive, responsive place. So those were some of the ideas that drove the process. I really wanted to make a piece wherein dancers utilize their voices, because language is so inherent in the genre of manifestos. So I looked for performers who could mobilize their voices, not only in singing, but also in speaking.
It looks like you have multiple body types as well as part of Hope Moore Dance. Is that part of your foundation?
Definitely. I feel aesthetically that it's really interesting to have, quote, trained and untrained bodies sharing the space together. So that's a value I have in casting.
When did you first hear the music of Beth Wilmert and want to involve her with your work?
Beth and I worked together last year on a production of Ann Carson's Antigonic for Shotgun Players. I really loved the music that she made for that production. And so I reached out to her to collaborate on Manifesting. And in fact, one of the performers in Manifesting was also in Antigonic. Kenny Toll is in the cast.
Beth Wilmert, this must be a concept that you bought into. What specifically did you think of in terms of Hope's vision of a manifesto that would become manifest in your music?
Well, Hope wrote the script, and she gave me a lot of text that she was using and asked me to kind of look through it and distill it and just pick out anything that kind of strikes me and then put some vocal music to it. So I started to kind of pluck out these fragments that struck me and thought that since we were working with a mix of talent, dancers, and a few people who had done a little bit of singing before, I thought that these fragments musically would work well because we could layer them on top of each other and have some interlocking harmonies. And we're doing all a cappella music, so just vocal, like we did in Antigonic.
Yeah, Beth worked a lot with the idea of fragments because I feel like that's a consistent conceptually with the genre of manifestos. Manifestos are inherently a compressed and distilled form. And also something Beth and I talked a lot about is making music for dancers and what it means to have non-trained singers singing. So we've done a lot of vocal coaching, and it's been really fascinating to have an ongoing discussion with the cast about how dancers breathe versus how singers breathe and things like that.
Because the dancing can certainly exhaust the muscles for then having to sing something. So I see where the fragments come in quite correctly or quite helpfully.
Right. Yeah, you have to isolate different muscles sometimes. Dancers are used to holding maybe kind of some of the more upper muscles, I'm not sure. But you really have to let go of a lot of that hold to get the deeper breath for the singing. And a lot of these fragments are coming right out of some pretty rigorous movement.
Well, we won't ask you to dance on radio, but you have offered to sing a little bit of Hope's Beth's music. What are we going to hear?
We call this the Rules Fugue, and it's just an a cappella fugue based on following rules.
All right.
It's two of the fragments together, and yeah.
In our studios. Here we go.
When you follow each rule and can discard your list to stand self-reliantly in a list-free environment, you prove to yourself that you can go on alone. I follow each rule to stand self-reliantly. I follow each rule to stand self-reliantly. I follow each rule to stand self-reliantly. I follow each rule to stand self-reliantly.
Music of Beth Wilmert with words by Hope Moore as part of Manifesting, which will be at the ODC Theater Thursday tonight through Saturday at 8 p.m. Information at odcdance.org. Great stuff.
Thank you.
Very
Thank
nice. You. In addition, in that clip that I also saw, I saw a lot of paper moving around. Are these the various manifesti that people are making and then perhaps changing or discarding?
Yeah, in the course of the piece, the performers are writing their own personal artist manifestos, and as with all ideology, things get a little out of hand. One of my interests in making the piece was to explore the dangers of dogmatism. And so as they get further into their manifesto process, they get very worked up, and the paper ends up all over the room.
We're also going to be treated to an encore presentation of last year's work, Stay. For those who missed it, could you tell us a little bit about that work?
Sure. It's my choreographic response to painter Francis Bacon. I was drawn to working with his paintings as source material because they combine formal composition and disturbing subject matter, and I found that combination to be very compelling. I also like the way that his paintings provide an emotional experience that's nonetheless non-narrative. And in making the work, I set out not to recreate his images per se, but to recreate the visceral impact that they have on the viewer.
And that has a sound design by Teddy Hulsker. What does he do?
He is masterful in making surprising collages of sound, and he's put together a soundscape for the piece that's really rich and lush and distinctive.
So this is more more contemporary dance than it is a performance art piece, the way that Manifesting is coming
exactly. out. I think it's an interesting program because Manifesting is very language-based and Stay is pure dance. It's much more technical. It's much more, quote, dancey. And there's not a scrap of text in it.
So tell us about your company then, and who is chosen for Stay versus, you mentioned you had to find some special people that could also sing, that could take part in Manifesting.
Yeah, like so many choreographers, I'm a project-based company. So I cast projects, very specifically depending on the content. So for Stay, I cast technical dancers. And for Manifesting, I was looking for performers who could use their voices. So two different casting processes.
Mm-hmm. Performances are tonight through Saturday at 8 p.m. ODC. The theater is at 17th Street, 3153 17th Street. Information at odcdance.org. For all things Hope More, you can go to Hope More. That's H-O-P-E-M-O-H-R. .org. And to see what Beth Wilmert is up to, her website, Beth Wilmert, WILMURT.com. Let's hear a little bit more of Beth's music as part of Manifesting that you will hear this weekend at ODC Theater. But let me first thank both Hope and Beth for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
It's your Stay at Home Mama, a rising CEO, a teacher, an entrepreneur. Everybody needs a manifesto. If you're a personal trainer, a driver of a Google bus, a life coach. Everybody needs a manifesto.
Everybody needs a manifesto. Ain't it the truth? For anyone who's tried to rise above it all and hasn't quite made it, there's a show at the Marsh you should see. 80 Lady offers you a riotous tour through 21st century San Francisco and all its quirkiness, and she does it alone with direction from David Ford in her solo show From Piss to Bliss, which runs Wednesdays and Saturdays at the Marsh through July 9th. A native of the Bay Area and a UC Berkeley grad, 80 has been performing on stage for more than 30 years. She wrote and performed her first one-woman show only recently, Whatever Happened to Sarah Jane, which premiered at the 2012 San Francisco Fringe Festival and was performed to enthusiastic audiences at the Marsh, Stageworks, and the L.A. Women's Theater Festival. Adie, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Glad to have you here. Well, give us a brief synopsis, if you would, on this path to higher consciousness you're seeking and pursuing in this show.
Well, it really attempts to embrace both the highest and the most base of our natures. We are always our highest aspirations and ultimately walking bags of goo, so to speak. and this really tries to be okay with both at the same time.
Okay. Well, I guess the underlying question in this work is framed as, can we be our best selves during our worst moments?
Yes, exactly. I was taking these amazing meditation classes for a while and having these glorious epiphanies about life and love and humanity and feeling so high. And then I would come back to San Francisco and get on Muni, and all of a sudden, all of those notions would be challenged. And I struggled with it not feeling true in those moments. And if it felt true in other moments, but not in these moments, was it true? And so I began this quest to love mankind while on the bus.
And that can be a challenge, can't it?
It can be a challenge, yes.
So how does Muni figure into your creative process?
Well, it certainly inspired the entire first section of the show. I found myself, trying to make rhyme and reason of my experiences and trying to interpret these experiences as though it was one of my dreams, like all there for me. So what does this mean? And why is this man screaming about golden showers? And, you know, what do I do with this? How do I make light of this? How do I find knowledge and truth in this? And it really became a fun quest after a while.
So this inspiration from uni is sometimes coming to you in unwelcome ways.
Absolutely. Mostly unwelcome ways. Very few of them were ever welcome.
I had a dear friend who referred to San Francisco as the island of misfit toys.
Yes.
Which I think figures into your creative process as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I love the diversity in San Francisco. And I like that everyone who has a flag to fly can find a place to fly it in San Francisco.
It's a bubble, but it's our bubble, isn't it?
Absolutely, and a good one.
So where else is inspiration coming on this path to enlightenment?
Well, I also used to lead Segway tours in Golden Gate Park.
That sounds like a blast. I see those going by. In fact, I saw some today.
Yeah, it is. It's a fascinating job, trust me. And you meet people from all over the world, and you take many of them outside of their comfort zones and teach them a new skill, and then take them around the park and share all the history. But mostly you're guiding people on new adventures. And at the same time, I was finding a lot of symbolism in that and beginning every conversation with words like, I'm your guide. You know, just find a way to relax. Trust, just trust. And it's effortless. It's easy if you let it be easy. And all of these felt like they were statements about life as well.
Well, behind the theater, the band shell at Golden Gate Park is where the Segway tours start. And
yes.
I know there's a little training session that goes on. And I remember biking by there one time when this guy had just fallen off the Segway. You know, I know it's a rarity, but and then there the Segway was doing fine. It was just bouncing back and forth, and he was on the pavement. And as I biked by, I said, that's why you sign the insurance waivers, guys.
Oh, yes, yes. There's quite a waiver to sign. But it is fun. And falling is not such a rarity, but most people just bounce right back up. It's mostly a bruise to the ego.
So is it more the different personalities you've encountered on these tours that gives you some fodder for your show?
Certainly. And some of the accident stories, really. It's how people handle the discomfort of something new. And some people can ride it, so to speak, and others have a really hard time trusting and letting go. And so for the people who really struggle, there's a story there.
Well, give us an example of something from a Segway tour that ended up in your show.
Well, there was a woman who was pretty high strung and a nervous person by nature, I could tell, and she did all right, but after trying to go down the first steep hill, she didn't lean back and control her speed. She lost control. She fell in a patch of flowers, was physically fine, but so emotionally shaken that she burst into tears and then cried at the top of every single hill we came to for the rest of the tour. So I ended up having to coax her down the hill each and every time by walking backwards in front of her.
So you're tour guide and therapist at the same time.
Yes, right? Yes, ultimately,
and
yes.
That, I guess, comes through in the show as well, therapy sessions.
Yes, and that section of the show, the tour guide, is really almost a scary self-help guru. I've sort of tapped into something almost somewhere a cross between that and a Baptist preacher, I think. There's some shame and salvation in there as well, and which one do you choose? And when salvation is there for the taking, why do we choose shame? You know, these big life questions, all found on a segue.
Indeed. Now, even with more than 30 years of stage performance to your credit, solo work isn't something that was initially in your wheelhouse. Now, I know this is your second solo show, and what gave you that push to go it alone?
I kept hearing from people that I should do this, and I never felt inclined to do it. It always felt like it was, like you said, out of my wheelhouse. And finally, after repeated suggestions and, again, signs coming up everywhere that maybe I should try this, I needed a creative outlet. The company I was working on with a friend was sort of defunct at that point, and I needed something to try, and so I just took a random class with David Ford at the Marsh. It was the first time I ever tried anything like that, and I just kept going back until I had a show.
So this started out as part of the Marsh Rising program, is that right?
Actually, it was just a class initially, and at the end of every class cycle, there's a 15-20-minute performance you do, and I did a couple of those and then began, you know, taking some private sessions with David to complete the show. And then I did have a Marsh Rising with that first show. That was a fascinating family saga involving Sarah Jane Moore and her attempt on Ford's life in 75. That was you know, what David called the narrative good fortune of my upbringing. And I had a great time doing that. And I'm thinking about, you know, reworking that and making it shorter and bringing that back, too, once I have this From Piss to Bliss rolling.
So is it something about the solo show that now gets your adrenaline pumping that you're excited about?
There's a wonderful rapport with the audience. There's very little fourth wall that you have. And so you're dealing directly with the crowds and feeding from the energy. And there's nobody else on the stage there with you. So you really only have the audience to work with. And every show is different as a result, which is a lot of fun and a little unnerving. And I have found almost a soldier feeling sometimes when there's a more unresponsive audience. And I'm finding, the faces and seeing that they're interested and getting something out of it. And it's different from an uproarious howling crowd, but still very gratifying. And, you know, it's been a wonderful experience. I've really enjoyed it.
Nice. And I'm curious, as a solo performer, what gives you the cues for the next segment of your show? If you're alone on stage, you can't rely on someone else's lines to feed you. What's next?
Well, I know it backwards and forwards by the time I'm getting up there. And memorization has fortunately been something that's never been too difficult for me. So as far as the energy and the flow goes, I really do find that with the audience. And it becomes just a rapport and a conversation that I'm having.
Well, it's hard to mention anything at the Marsh without invoking David Ford, as you did just earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And he's your director on this. What has he brought to the process for you?
Brevity, economy. I sometimes say things several times. I will keep talking until I see the nod of recognition or something in the face of the other person. And David has been there to say, oh, you already said that. You know, oh, they don't need to hear that again. Oh, let's cut that right there. And does it in such a way that I don't mind letting it go. Even if I've labored and bled over the words on the page, they're easy to let go with David somehow. He is a master of brevity. And for me, that has been gold. They would be much more clunky and much longer and much more rambling without the input of David Ford.
That's great to know. I'm looking forward to the show then. Are you still pursuing ensemble acting opportunities then? Or is this the solo bug your now main pursuit?
At this point, I'm focusing on the solo work. It's been enormously gratifying, both as a writer and a performer. The friend with whom I used to do the ensemble work, he wrote some really fantastic shows, and so we are constantly talking about bringing those back. I don't know that I would go out and pursue ensemble work in a traditional fashion, but I would, in a heartbeat, I think, jump at the opportunity to do some of the shows with my friend again.
And stage, are you interested in other acting pursuits in terms of film or ensemble work?
Oh, I'm enormously open, yes. I love performing. And so in any capacity that happens, I'm quite happy to do it.
So are there other solo works in floating around that brain of yours?
Well, at this point, From Piss to Bliss and The Sarah Jane Show are both vying for attention, but I do know that another one is out there. I'm not exactly sure what it is yet, though. But it will come, I'm sure.
Well, we'll keep informed by adylady.com. Is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, absolutely.
adylady.com. Mm-hmm. AD Lady in From Piss to Bliss is at the Marsh on Valencia Street here in San Francisco, Wednesdays and Saturdays through July 9th. More information at themarsh.org. AD, I wish you a wonderful run, and we look forward to having another conversation down the road.
Thank you so much.
Still to come, Harvey Malloy offers more details about the Berklee Festival and exhibition, but next, more dance. Bandaloop, The Village Impacts, and Illuminate present SF Public Canvas next Thursday, June 16th through Sunday the 19th in San Francisco's Tenderloin Central Market neighborhood. It's a large-scale, multimedia, vertical dance project that fuses art and technology to create public discourse and will be performed on the exterior of the Hastings School of Law building on Golden Gate Avenue. It's a collaboration between media artist Jonathan Rowe of the Village Impacts, choreographer Amelia Rudolph, and her company Bandaloop, and producing partner Illuminate. Amelia is a choreographer, dancer, athlete, teacher, and community leader whose work is informed by natural and built spaces, human relationships, and by non-traditional relationships with gravity. She founded Bandaloop in 1991, bringing together dance, climbing, and varied off-the-ground movement into site-reactive performances on things such as cliffs, urban structures, and in theaters. Vandaloop has recently been designated by the Tricia Brown Company to remount and perform Brown's seminal work, Man Walking Down the Side of a Building, exclusively throughout the world. Welcome, Amelia.
Thank you.
She's joined by Tatiana Willis, Youth Speaks poet in residence, who worked with Amelia to create a connective through line for this presentation. She is an accomplished writer, actress, and singer, and has been a leader in Youth Speaks programs such as Spokes Youth Advisory Board, Brave New Voices, Team Bay Area, and Future Corps. She also just completed the historic run of Anna Deavere Smith's Notes from the Field at Berkeley Rep, acting as a facilitator for their community engagement process that reached over 12,000 audience members. Welcome to you, Tatiana.
Hi.
Welcome back. Welcome back to our airwaves. I understand you've done some things with us before. That's great.
Yes.
Well, let's get a little bit of background on what exactly is Bandaloop.
We're a dance company. We are almost 25 years old now. And back in 91, I, as a dancer, went to the Sierra, fell in love with rock climbing and the mountains and the mountain environment itself, and sort of had an epiphany one day high on a cliff, sort of clinging to a granite edge, wondering what would it be like if I brought together these two worlds of dance and mountaineering, climbing technology and movement. And this is the result. So we travel the world, performing in theaters on buildings. We bring dance out of its sort of traditional trappings and take away barriers for people to come see dance by bringing it to the people, to the streets. It sort of democratizes dance in many ways. And it allows us to activate public spaces like Hastings Law School, and what's actually the base of that wall is called Demonstration Gardens, there in the Tenderloin, which I'm really looking forward to.
I understand that this particular project was the actually result of a happy accident.
That is true. So Jonathan Rowe, who is my media collaborator, was interested in getting involved. There was a grant opportunity to bring together technology and the arts. And he, being a tech person who does media, was interested in trying to find a way to put technology in the public sphere and was interested in that grant. And then we, too, were. And then one of the sort of people involved in that world said, hey, I happen to know this guy who needs a art organization to work with to activate his media, and you need somebody who, you know, the media component to activate your art. And so the two will meet, or did meet. And we've been getting to know each other. We didn't actually know each other at all before this project. And our worlds are very different, and it's a fascinating process to weave things together. And then, if I can add to that, there was another sort of interesting twist to this, which was because we're soliciting public art material, we got a video from Youth Speaks. And I looked at this video and I got so excited about it that this really, as even though it was sort of originally submitted somewhat as public material, art material or content, it ended up turning into a much larger relationship and collaboration with Tatiana and Youth Speaks.
And apparently that's where Tatiana comes in. So Tatiana, yes. How exactly is spoken word incorporated into the project?
Spoken word is incorporated as kind of like the voices of all the material that that was received during the process, and kind of voicing the, you know, ideas around, you know, what's happening in San Francisco. So it's incorporated all throughout very differently, not just spoken word as in like just one poem, but also in singing, also in voice, and just ways to project your ideas and feelings, kind of like the voice of tech and dance, you know, which are seen as, you know, not talking so much, you know, art forms, but like we get to be the voice of that, which is really awesome.
So this is a very specific neighborhood project. And you mentioned that outreach into the community is very important. How exactly, there are a lot of challenges in the Tenderloin. I'm sure you know well, or you've discovered even more throughout the process.
And we're certainly not going to figure it out. What I do hope that we do, well, first of all, we went into the community and we did what I call town hall meetings. We went to Boys and Girls Club. We went to Tenderloin Museum. We went to kids' classes. We did something at Demonstration Gardens. So basically, we tried to create community events where we asked people questions like, what does home mean to you? What change do you want to see here? And had them respond in art and photographs and writing and words. We talked to kids. We talked to grown-ups. We talked to people living in the area. So that was, you know, the way that we did a lot of outreach. We also did it through social media. So there was a lot of, you know, you can hashtag it, and you still can, hashtag it SF Public Canvas on Instagram or Facebook, and we'll find it. And then we have been bringing in, and Jonathan and his team has been bringing in all this visual media, mostly visual media, and then collaging it and using it, and we're making choices of how we can interact and bring to life this material. I keep saying, he says content, I say artistic material, and to bring it to life with the work.
Well, what sort of things will we be seeing other than people climbing on walls?
Well, first of all, they'll be dancing on walls, and the choreography, I'm very excited to show a lot of this new choreography that's part of the show. Additionally, I'm going to throw another one, little note about Youth Speaks, because we had an experiment where I really wanted to get one of the poets off the ground. So I asked Tessiana, would anybody do that? And it turns out one of the poets agreed, and I trained with him, or we trained together in the Band Loop studio and on the wall, and he will be delivering this amazing poem.
Benjamin Turner
from walking down the wall. So that's one thing.
Fantastic.
But the media elements of it are quite incredible. I mean, Jonathan is really showing off much of what tech can be. Taking the content, and his team is also doing these incredible animations. Some of the content is being animated, some of it is more to animate ideas and transitions. So he's got a team working on that. And you'll see all kinds of things. You'll see dancers get squeezed into boxes that turn into towers that disappear into the wall. We have infrared bands on our hands so they can track us on the wall, and we can interact and move the media around.
Wow. Okay, Amelia, what will we hear besides the poetry?
An amazing musical score by the musical director and composer Ben Univakis, as well as music by Gideon Freudman and DJ Spooky. And of course, Camposanto will be also singing an amazing piece, and Tassiana herself will be singing as well.
Wonderful. That's fantastic. Well, it's so wonderful that you're giving this great public display of technology in an area that's now being infiltrated by technology, but people are probably seeing it only as they're going into these big boxes and doing technology. They're not bringing it out to show us what's going on. So kudos to you for bringing it to the neighborhood.
Well, and I hope this is about bridging the arts, the community, and the technology, and inviting the technology companies and a community to think about the community they're in and the people they are interacting with. And I hope it's also an opportunity for people living in the area to consider how technology, aside from the difficulties, may be able to bring some forward motion and connection between people, which is really something I'm hoping for. There's certainly the project, it expresses the frustration and difficulties as well. So it really does both.
What's the best website to learn more about the project?
I'd say the easiest one is actually it has its own website, which is sfpubliccanvas.org. There's also, you can find it at bandaloop.org, and a Facebook page, which is the hashtag sfpubliccanvas as well.
Amelia Rudolph, Tassiana Willis, thanks so much for coming in. I hope you have a wonderful performance, and we look forward to seeing it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Once again, this Illuminate Bandaloop SF Public Canvas, it runs next Thursday, the 16th, through Sunday, the 19th, on the wall of the Hastings Law School on Golden Gate Avenue. Thank you. That's Christian Bezuidenhout in an excerpt from Mozart's Sonata in C, Kürschel 309, a work you can hear in its entirety this very afternoon at 5 as part of the Berklee Festival. Last week we heard from my guest Hanneke van Prusdijk about the Voices of Music performance with guest violinist Rachel Podger in music of Bach and Vivaldi. That's happening tonight at 8, in fact, at the First Congregational Church in Berklee. But there's so much more ahead for the Berklee Festival, which ends this Sunday. Here to tell us about the remaining events in the festival, or at least part thereof, is Harvey Molloy, Executive Director of the presenting San Francisco Early Music Society. Harvey, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you, Dave.
I should say welcome back, because we have talked before with some other groups that you've had here.
We have. I'm usually shepherding them in and out, so...
So Christian will be doing a recital this afternoon, Mozart Reincarnated, that's how he is described.
He's quite a remarkable interpreter of Mozart. It's wonderful to come and hear him, and in fact, he's playing a fortepiano that was loaned to us by Nick McGeegan. This is the second time he's playing on this particular instrument. He performed a debut recital here on the West Coast on the 2014 festival, and we were absolutely thrilled to have him. But Nick, when he heard his piano being played by Christian, said, "Oh my God, I never knew that that piano could make those sounds." And when you hear Christian Bezuidenhout play the forte piano, you realize what a wonderful dynamic and charming instrument it is, and it helps you to really creatively reimagine what this music was like.
Well, for people that may not be familiar, the forte piano was the predecessor of our modern piano, and was called the forte piano because it could
be forte and piano,
as opposed to the harpsichord, which was its immediate predecessor, which could be just a little plunk.
That's right. It's not a plucked instrument. It's a hammered instrument. So it is the forerunner of our current pianoforte, but it's much more subtle. And for people who don't know, our approach in the San Francisco Early Music Society has always been the recreation of music. We call it the historically informed performance of this music, which means that we use instruments that are close facsimiles of the originals, bowing techniques and bows that are also facsimiles of the originals as best we can. There's obviously lots of scholarship into the music and how it was performed, but of course there are no recordings of the way this music sounded. And so scholars, 40 years ago when I became involved with this music, it was largely a matter of scholarship and book learning. But now, what's amazing to me, and I've come back to this relatively late in my career, because I took a bit of a detour for 30 plus years into the business world and came back to this as a kind of retirement career. But what's remarkable to me is how people have internalized all the scholarship, and they've made this music entirely fresh and new. And it is such a remarkable creative exercise when you hear music performed at this level. And it's a creative exercise for both the performer and for the listener, because now you can really reimagine, as you hear this, what it was like to experience this music in its original setting.
Well, we'd mentioned Christian performing this afternoon. He's also going to be appearing this Saturday with the aforementioned Rachel Podger in some Bach sonatas for violin and harpsichord.
Yes. And part of the concept here, I know you've had on this program before, our president, San Francisco Early Music Society president, Robert Cole, who was the founder of this wonderful festival back in 1990. But Robert's concept of a festival was always to take the most significant international artists, bring them together in Berklee combine them with many of the local talents, and we have a very deep pool of local talents here in the Bay Area, and allow for an experience that is impossible anywhere else. So as far as I know, Rachel Podger and Chris Bezetenhout have not performed in concert as a duo before. So this is a unique experience to hear these two wonderful virtuosos.
And again, that's going to be Saturday evening at 8 o'clock. On that Saturday also, the aforementioned Nicholas McGeegan will be conducting the Philharmonia Baroque Players with Juilliard 415. Now, that's a clever title. I'm imagining it's Juilliard grads that are in the 415 area code. Is that right?
No, but no. That's what it sounds like. That's a good way to imagine it. No, well, no, Juilliard 415 is not Juilliard graduates. They are Juilliard students. And this early music program, historically informed music at Juilliard, is a relatively new program that they have. And it is directed by Robert Mealy. Robert Mealy is one of our 415 people, and then he comes from the Bay Area, born and raised in Berkeley, was a participant in our San Francisco Early Music Society summer workshops, and now has gone off among other responsibilities he has. He's the director of this early music program at Juilliard. The ensemble at Juilliard is called 415 because of the tuning. The A is
very clever.
415 rather than 440, which is our standard tuning today.
And why is that? Can you give us just a nutshell of why the tuning was lower back in the day?
You know, I'm not really the one to ask about that because that's a deep and difficult subject.
Well, tunings are especially...
And in fact, we do, if people go to the website, there are a number of seminars, and some will be dealing with tuning specifically and performance practice, and you'll be able to work with people who are here from people who know far more about it than I do. But obviously, when we had gut strings, for example, there was a comfort level at a little bit lower tuning. So it was possibly started there. But that's sort of the standard 415, and when we think of a 415, we know we're talking about historically informed performance of Baroque music in particular.
Mm-hmm. So given that we're talking about these earlier instruments, are the venues that you're performing in a little bit more intimate than a large
hall?
Yes,
we only have, on our main stage, we're performing only in two venues. One is First Congregational Church in Berkeley, and the other is St. Mark's, also in Berkeley. They're only a block apart. First Congregational is a little bit bigger. It seats about 600. St. Mark's is much more intimate, about 280, maybe 300 people. And obviously, this music was meant to be heard in a chamber. It's truly chamber music.
Mm-hmm.
And sounds very nice in this kind of hall. So we're very happy to have these two venues.
I mentioned that the Philharmonia Baroque Players with Juilliard 415, Nicholas McGeegan conducting. An intriguing title of their presentation, this is going to be at 4 o'clock on Saturday, June 11th, Music of Shakespeare.
Yes, and it's all sort of theatrical works. Obviously, this is a anniversary year for Shakespeare. Hate to say celebration, but a commemoration of the 400th year of his passing. And so we've actually had one other Shakespeare-oriented program that was on Tuesday evening with the Parthenia Consort. Parthenia is coming up again in combination with Robert Mealy, who you we just spoke about, who brought his Juilliard 415 out here, and with Shira Kamen, who's a local viol player and a phenomenal talent, able to do almost anything.
And that's part of Friday's concert series. That's tomorrow at 5 o'clock, Parthenia with Robert Mealy and Shira Kamen. And they're also an intriguing title on their program, Musical Games.
Yes. And, you know, it's sort of difficult to describe each one of these programs for me because it's so broad. I look at this festival, and if people want to go to the website, which is berkeleyfestival.org, and look, really this festival is all about discovery and surprise. So you really can't know what to expect. We have Robert Cole has brought together all these diverse people from the East Coast, from Europe, from our local pool of talent, brought them together on the stage. And the theme of this festival, if there is one, is in concert and in consort. So what we find is, for example, we were talking about Philharmonia Baroque chamber players playing with Juilliard 415. Well, we all know what Philharmonia Baroque can do in concert, but in consort with Juilliard 415, it's a bit of a new experience, and that's what we're doing. The same is true with a Parthenia consort, which people heard earlier in the week by themselves, but now with Robert Mealy and with Shira Kamen, they form a whole new ensemble and are recreated. It's a process of discovery that people, I think, will enjoy. So
part of that discovery is so much more than just the main concerts that are going on. For instance, tomorrow it looks like a double feature is happening, starting at 1 o'clock as part of the Early Music Film Festival. At 1, it's going to be Live to Be 100, A Year in the Life of Ton Koopman. And then at 2:30, The Chronicle of Anna Magdalena Bach. What is The Chronicle of Anna Magdalena Bach?
Well, it's quite... I actually haven't seen the film. I'm looking forward to seeing it. This is, as far as I know, also the first Early Music Film Festival. And we were quite pleased that the Berkeley Art Museum Pacific Film Archive was willing to partner with us on this project. In fact, the idea of having a film festival was David Taylor's of Voices of Music. And he pushed us on this idea, and Robert reached out to the Pacific Film Archive, and now we have this Early Music Film Festival, and I think it will be quite a revelation to us all, because most of us have not seen all these films, and The Chronicle of Anna Magdalena Bach, while I know it's a favorite of many, I haven't seen, but I'm looking forward to it.
I'm just reading here, it's from 1968.
Yes.
Wow.
But you can imagine that there aren't many forums where you are able to see these things. So this is a unique chance to be able to see it.
It looks like Shira Kamen is doing some double duty, as many of your performers are, not only on Friday with Parthenia, but then on Saturday, she and friends are doing a concert in honor of Marguerite Tindemans. Tell us about Marguerite.
Marguerite was a wonderful viola da gamba player. She was actually supposed to perform on the 2014 festival, but she became ill just before the festival, and she was not able to perform, and she since has passed away. So this is in remembrance of her, and she has very strong roots in this community, in part because she's been on our faculty at the Baroque Workshop for many, many years. So we feel very close to her, and we wanted to take this opportunity to remember her. And when we think about remembering people who are important to this community, the finale, which is a wonderful program by the by Vox Luminous, the very gifted voices of Vox Luminous. In fact, Robert Cole says that they're a vocal ensemble that is unparalleled. They are concluding our festival on Sunday.
That's a 4 o'clock concert?
Yes, with a funeral mass for Queen Mary by Purcell.
Wonderful music.
Yeah, wonderful music. And at that, we are going to remember Lee McCrae, who many in this community do know. She was one of the founders of Arler Music Society. She was one of the founders of this festival. She was the first agent for many of the significant international artists who toured the United States. So she was Jordi Savall's agent. She was Franz Bruggen's agent. She was Hopkins and Smith's agent. She did a tremendous amount to bring the early music, the study of and performance of historically informed early music to not just the Bay Area, but to North America.
Wow.
And so we owe her a lot, and we're dedicating this final performance to her memory, and we're very happy to have had her as part of our community for so many years.
That'll be Vox Luminous with the Philharmonia Baroque Players, Purcell and Handel, a celebration of two great masters with a tribute to a third.
Yes.
4 o'clock Sunday, June 12th, to round out the festival. I should back up a moment about those films that we just mentioned, that they're going to be screened at the Berkeley Art Museum Pacific Film Archive, BAMFA.
BAMFA. Yes.
That's a fairly new venue, isn't it?
It's just maybe a month that it's been open. And we had a concert there, a wonderful concert by Sakabuche, on Sunday afternoon when we opened the festival in their lobby there. And it was quite a glorious occasion with lots of brass sackbuts and cornettos, and it was really wonderful, and it's a wonderful space. It's been repurposed and reclad, and wonderful theaters, all new equipment, and it's a must-visit kind of place if you come to Berkeley.
And that's at 2155 Center Street. Mentioning that there's so much going on in addition to, now we've got films, we've got presentations, we've got the major concerts, of course, and these amazing artists. But today and tomorrow, there are also EMA Young Performers Festival Series performances. Can you tell us a little bit about that program?
Yes, we've been partnering with Early Music America for many years, almost since the beginning of the festival. And they bring to the festival university collegia from around the country and present them in concert so that these young people get a chance to perform in a fully produced concert. And they also get to hear all these other artists while they're doing it. So we're thrilled to have Early Music America here as a partner in this festival. And as I say, it's very much worth spending an hour on, well, now it'll be Friday morning because too late now for Thursday's concerts. But it's well worth hearing where the next generation of musicians will be coming from.
Indeed. Well, in addition to all of the musical happenings now, we also have a place you can go for one-stop shopping for all things Baroque, and from music and instruments to supplies.
Again, right from the beginning of this, when Robert Cole founded this festival in 1990, he also had the idea of an early music exhibition and marketplace. And, you know, at the time, there were not many places where you could buy a viola da gamba.
Old curiosity shop, maybe, on some obscure street in London.
Certainly not in the United States.
Right.
But he started to bring people together, and now we have quite a significant number of people displaying music. But we have viol makers, we have violin makers, we have bow makers, historical bows, makers of historical bows, of historical flutes, recorders, of course, even clarinets, oboes, Baroque oboes are quite remarkable instrument. Several different harpsichord makers, as well as the Harpsichord Clearinghouse, which is, well, that's what they are. The Harpsichord Clearinghouse has quite a selection of instruments to choose from. There are some music publishers participating here. And you will also find some of our local performing ensembles, which will have tables there. We'll be promoting their events, taking subscriptions. You'll have Voices of Music there, Philharmonia Baroque there, American Bach Soloists there.
One-stop shopping. That's great.
One-stop. It's really remarkable.
The festival exhibition and marketplace takes place in the large and small assembly halls at First Congregational Church in Berkeley. And admission to the festival exhibition and marketplace is free. More information about the festival at berkeleyfestival.org. Other things that the San Francisco Early Music Society is up to at their website, sfems.org. Harvey, let's go out with some of the wonderful playing of violinist Rachel Pogner. We can hear her tonight with the Voices of Music, as you heard from my interview with the folks from them last week. And you can hear her again Saturday at 8 with Christian Bezuidenhout. Harvey, thanks for coming in. We look forward to the festival and many more wonderful happenings from SFEMS.
Thank you, David. And I might, for all the details on this festival, they really should go to berkeleyfestival.org.
Thanks again, Harvey.
Thank you.
In addition to the wonderful Berkeley Festival and Exhibition through this weekend, I encourage you to stop by Berkeley Rep. Their fantastic production of Treasure Island has been extended through June 19th. It's Mary Zimmerman's adaptation and direction of the Robert Louis Stevenson classic, with a cast headed by the charismatic young John Babbo as Jim Hawkins, and a virtuosic performance by Stephen Epp as Long John Silver. Tremendous production, and for all ages. BerkeleyRep.org for more information. That's it for Open Air this week. Niels Swinkels produces the show for me, your host, David LaTulipe. We're always open to suggestions for segment features. Send an email to david@klw.org. And a reminder that all of our shows are archived at the station's website, klw.org. Thanks for listening.